Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 27th through July 7th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own.
Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 347 of the Outlander podcast. I am still Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
And I think we have, well, we think all of our episodes are special, but this week, this episode, I think is extra fun, extra special, because I think we have a guest. Who is that joining us today?
It's Casey Dyer.
Hello. If you guys have been listening for a while, you might remember that we have had Casey on before. She also joined us for a read-along a number of years ago, and we were able to speak with her about her latest book at that time, Finding Fraser.
I was going to say, if you are familiar with Droughtlander
yes,
and looking for books to fill the void left by Outlander, you are very familiar with this book.
And so with that, this episode, we'd like thank especially huge thank you to co-producer Courtney G. Courtney G, thank you so much. You guys stick around to the very end of the show. We will talk about, as usual, I'll mention about what the co-producers are, how you can become one, or how you can find out more about this very unique way of supporting us and our show. And I think, without further ado, we need to hop into this interview. We are here speaking with author Casey Dyer. What made you ultimately want to be a writer and how you got here?
Okay, well, I mean, apart from a couple of years right out of university where I was a teacher, I've made my living from writing all the way through. So when my children were small, I wrote for a local newspaper and I was a freelance writer and I did some stuff like that. And then I started, at the turn of this century, I started trying to get a book published. And so it was while I was engaged in that process because I live in the woods in British Columbia, and in those days, all we had was dial-up for the internet. The only way that I could get online was to sign up with CompuServe, which is an American service provider. And when I joined with CompuServe, I discovered that they had the CompuServe Writers Forum. And so I was able to connect with other writers online from, you know, sometime like, I'm going to say 1996, 1997, sometime in there. And that's where that's where I met Diana for the first time was online. And many other friends that I've met through the CompuServe Writers Forum, I'm still friends with today, and widely published writers. It was an amazing forum. It still exists, not through CompuServe, but there's still a Books and Writers Forum online. And Diana's still one of the directors of that. So that's sort of part of the direction that brought me here. My first book was published in, I can't remember, 2000 or I think it actually came out in 2002. Don't you bark, mister. I'm sorry. I warned Ginger about this to begin with. There, now I think he's settled down. Sorry, my puppy in the background is locked out of the room and he's looking at me pleadingly through the window and now woofing at me. So the first book was published then. So 80 Days to Elsewhere is going to be my eighth novel that's published. And it was pretty much directly inspired by the adventures that Emma went on in Finding Fraser, which we talked about. I mean, I can't believe you guys are way up past 300 episodes. Can you believe it? That's amazing.
I don't know what to say.
The last time I talked to you, I think I was about like 130 or 140 episodes in. And so you've basically done double the amount of episodes since I last spoke to you. So like, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's exhausting. What happens when you have Diana Gabaldon-sized books.
Yeah, it's true.
And almost a year between series.
Yeah, so it's true.
But no, yeah, I'm not. I am sometimes, because we're moving at such a pace, I don't always reflect and say, holy crap. But when the time when I actually have a holy crap moment, and it's almost every week, but not for very long, is when I introduce the show and say, welcome to episode XYZ, whatever.
Yeah.
And, sorry,
yeah.
I just hit this. Welcome to episode XYZ or whatever. And sometimes Summer and I just like pause and she'll say like, good gosh, that's like,
yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. It's weird.
It's crazy.
It's odd.
Yeah. Well, I've been writing for a long time and it's a job that I love and I'm very lucky to have it. So that's basically the summation. I love making up stories and it's been especially fantastic this year because I consider myself very privileged and lucky in that I didn't lose my job when COVID hit and I was able to still stay at home. I'm finishing up the story that is going to come out subsequent to my new book, which is coming out like just in a couple of weeks. It's been a really fun world to be able to drop myself into, because sometimes the real world, you know, it's hard to watch it burn.
Your last two books have been very literary in nature, like literary based travel.
Yeah. So that's basically what the premise is for this new story, is that there's this company called Ex Libris, and what they do is they recreate literary journeys. And I got the idea for that strictly out of Emma in Finding Fraser deciding she was going to go chase down her own version of Jamie Fraser. So in Finding Fraser, at the beginning of the book, there's a little map tracing Emma's route. And Emma tries as best she can to trace Claire's journey through Scotland and fails at doing it, but tries. And so when I was writing that my next story, I thought, you know, that's kind of a cool idea. What if there was a company that actually did that, that actually took people on literary journeys? Now, for Outlander, we all know that there are amazing Outlander tours. Yeah. But that doesn't happen for every book.
But it should. And yeah. To be honest, this could be a whole Ex Libris series.
That's what I'm hoping. Yeah. So for
See?
Sure.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Stop it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Take your next book and create a new one.
For sure. There's two, because I'm just about finishing the second one. I have plans for three more, but I haven't signed for them. So we'll have to see how these do. So if everybody goes out and buys these books, then maybe they'll ask me to write some more. So that's what I'm hoping anyway, because I think it's such a good idea. And I love the character of Teresa Cypher, who runs Ex Libris. She's a very minor character in the story, but she's the core of the story. She's the puppet master. That's exactly right. And so she's also kind of like a goddess, right? Because she appears and disappears at will and really very much depending on the nature of the book that I'm, that the story is an homage to, right? So in this case, it's the story is sending up Around the World in 80 Days, which was an old book written by Jules Verne in the 1800s. It is just a terrible book. I read it when I was a teenager.
But she's don't read it, y'all.
Yeah, if you do, you have to read it like recognizing when it was written. So it was written by this privileged white male in the 1870s. And he wrote it, like he was living in Paris when he wrote it. He did not go anywhere to do research. So he just made it up.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. So, you know, there's scenes that are in like the depths of India where his main character, Phileas Fogg, rides an elephant, and it's incredibly misogynistic. It's very, very racist. And anyway, I'd forgotten because I read it when I was, you know, like 11 or 12, right? And I just thought, when I was pitching this novel, I thought, oh, this would be a fun idea. And I hadn't reread the book by then. And then to my shock and surprise, my publishing house bought the idea. And so I had to very, very quickly write the book.
Good.
had to read it.
Yeah. So I did what I did that was different than what he did is that I actually last year went around the world and I did a research trip to support this book. So a lot of the absolutely insane adventures that I had while I was going around the world ended up in this story. So it's it was like probably the most fun I've ever had writing a book.
What would be like your elevator pitch summation or the a quick summary of this so people understand kind of where it starts out? There is literary travel in the book, but it's not from that perspective. The perspective is from a main character. Can you tell us about Romy?
Okay, so Romy Keene has lived all her life in New York City, and she lives at above her uncle's bookstore. So they have a bookstore down in the East Village in New York, and it's called Two Old Queens Books and Tea, and it's just a lovely old secondhand bookstore, and she's always worked there. The story opens when there's a threat to the bookstore. Someone, a new landlord, takes over, and they're going to bump the rent, and there is a risk that that her uncles are going to lose the bookstore, and Romy has to find a way to help them keep the bookstore. And what she comes across an ad for this company that is looking for basically an intern who will retrace the steps of Phileas Fogg in Jules Verne's story Around the World in 80 Days. So this intern would retrace those steps in the contemporary world, like not in 1870, but in this day and age, for one of the company's clients who wants to do that tour. And the person who normally would do it had fallen and broken her arm, so is unable to make the trip herself. And the advantage to making this trip is that if she does this successfully, and she has a lot less than 80 days to do it in, but if she does it successfully, then they will offer her a job. And the job is a very secure job, and she will win a bonus of $10,000, which she can use to help her uncles keep the bookstore. So what starts as an endeavor to retrace this literary journey gets more complicated almost immediately when she finds out she's not the only person who's in the race. And so suddenly Around the World in 80 Days is crossed with The Amazing Race. And these two characters, one of whom turns out to be related to the mortal enemy of her family, the man who's trying to take down the bookstore, race each other around the world to try to win this $10,000. So that's essentially the elevator pitch for this book.
I would like to be a competitor in this race because that job sounds amazing.
It does. It does. And it's a... It was truly amazing, and everything. You know, I write romantic comedy. There is a love story in this book, and it develops as the story goes along. But nothing goes right. Nothing goes right for poor Romy as she's racing around the world, and there's one disaster after another. And best part for me was that, you know, I mentioned how terrible Jules Verne's book was. Like, Jules Verne was a very popular writer right out of the gate, kind of like Diana Gabaldon in a way, like very popular almost immediately. But his genre was science fiction. And to go around the world in 80 days in 1870 was science fiction. So this was a science fiction story. But remarkably enough, there is a love story in his book too. And so this is why it was kind of perfect for what I wanted to do. And I was able to take all the terrible tropes that he has and try to send them up. You know, I've got this modern young woman who feels like she's woke and knows about the world and you know, has a very diverse selection of friends and feels like she's on top of things politically and everything like this. And then she goes out into this great big world and she learns how much she doesn't know. And so the whole experience is about learning who she is and what happens when she falls in love along the way.
See, and what I love about that is that that is one of the like things that you learn as you travel is how little you don't know. Mm-hmm. And you just start having enormous empathy that you never feel when you never leave your hometown, empathy that you never feel when you never branch out and try to learn about other societies and other things. And those are just things you can't learn without experiencing it, right? So it's like that was one of the major messages that I loved in this, is that she did make missteps along the way, but she grew as a character and in ways that were amazing and beautiful, and not just, you know, I found a guy.
Yeah.
I feel like she really just became a fuller person.
She had to find out who she was, and she had to face her fears. So, you know, without giving too much away, one of the things that she takes very little with her when she goes on this journey, but she takes this old suitcase that she's kept under her bed, just to store things in, basically her winter clothes in the summer, that sort of thing. It's the only suitcase she has. And so she takes it on the journey with her. But this suitcase has tremendous significance to her because it belonged to her parents. And we know from the beginning of the story that Romy lives with her uncles, but we don't really know why. And so that element of the story unfolds, and she has to face, this is a girl who is very, very motivated by fear. And I think a lot of us can understand that. And so for her, the tremendous amount of bravery that it takes to actually go out and face those fears and to not just hide at home, for her, it's worth it because she's trying to help her uncles and their bookstore. And for me, I feel like Romy has a lot of flaws. She's not terribly likable at the beginning of the book, but as the story comes along and she learns more about the way the world works and why she is the way that she is, then I think we come to understand her more. I hope so anyway.
Well, it's funny that we are talking about another one of your books that, in a different way, but with a similar vein, right? The vein of, or the topic of literary excursion travel. Mm-hmm. It's funny that when we first spoke about Finding Fraser, we weren't doing this. And then in 2018, we took our first, we formed it a little bit before that. But in 2018, May, I think, we did our first Pod Abroad tour, which is we got with a Scottish tour operator, and we have a friend who is a Scottish tour guide. We had an itinerary built, had everything, you know, priced, set up, and then we're able to fully book a tour, which was predominantly based on filming locations of Outlander, but it also includes a lot of information and stuff, you know, from just general Scottish history. And because a lot of people who go on that like the books as well, it was a lot of book stuff, I guess, thrown in there as well. And so all that to say, I guess technically we're in that business. We do, although it's not, it's like a side, I hate to even call it a business because we do it obviously for pleasure. And that, I mean, that's the best way to do a business if you're going to do it. But, you know, it's not more than one trip a year. Like we're not doing a ton of these. And matter of fact, the two we had this year, it was three trips, but only we were going to do, I think, no, sorry, two this fall. We're actually alumni trips because yes, people come back and travel more with us.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was supposed to be this fall. And unfortunately, we understand because of all, you know, all the stuff this year, the pandemic and everything, they've been at this moment rescheduled for postponed until next fall.
Yeah. So
there's some loss with that, but I didn't mean to go there. My point is, it's funny that after you have that, and we talk about Finding Fraser, you know, years later, we do that. And we've done two now, 2018, 2019, and then we'll continue in the future. And here's your next book. And then you tell us that you potentially have more. I mean, so unless what your answer would be would give away something from a future book, which obviously we don't want to do.
I do. I want her to.
Well, she's not going to tell us. We don't want to spoil it or have you, give away anything you don't want to give away. But because we all seem to, and I think a lot of Outlander fans, seem to enjoy, I think would enjoy literary excursion travel, is there a book that maybe because of how small it is or how large it is or the sheer quantity or the sheer scale of what it would entail to actually try and retrace those steps, is there something that's like a dream fantasy of yours to do, but that you can tell us about? Because if it is something that you love and it's going to be in a book, you may not want to tell us, but is there something that you would love?
Well, you know, the reason I picked Around the World in 80 Days, when I got this idea, when I was thinking, what book would I use? And I thought, well, I've never been all the way around the world. And I would love to do that. And I would I'm going to have to do that if I'm doing research, right? So I thought, okay, well, I'll do that. But really what I wanted was to see India. That was the most important thing for me. I really wanted to see India. I had never seen it. And I grew up reading, you know, The Jewel in the Crown and Rohinton Mysteries books and, you know, just so many books about the Raj and books about history of, anyway, it was such a magical, magical country for me. So this really was a huge dream come true for me. And I had the most amazing time when I was in India. It was just astonishing. I was there last summer when they were in the middle of a heat wave, the monsoon that comes normally on June 15th, like it's almost that predictable, got sucked back out to sea by a cyclone that hit the northern part of India and Bangladesh. And so as a result, I was there during a heat wave and without the monsoon, I mean, the monsoon is an incredible event, but without it, the water shortages start to kill people. And so there was these massive water shortages. It was just, it is a country that is just so, it is continual motion. It is in continual movement and it's so filled with color and poverty, like extreme poverty and massive extreme wealth and the contrast. It is a country of contrast and it's just, I had the best time ever being there. So yeah. So any book that, that involves India, I'm there. I'm in there.
Well, I have to mention it because Romy said a few times, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
Pray, love.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
So I take it Eat, Pray, Love is not going to be one of your ex Libris travel agencies.
No, well, it's funny because that was actually my agent's joke because so she loved the Eat, Pray, Love connection. And then, of course, you know, Romy ends up kissing the guy in Malaysia and she, you know, anyway, so there's like, there are a lot of echoes of Eat, Pray, Love through it, even though I have to say that was a book that I personally didn't enjoy very much. I feel like there's a big difference. And again, I'm going to step away from talking about that book in particular, but there's a big difference when a person who has tremendous privilege gets to travel around the world like a queen, as opposed to somebody who gets to see the way people actually live. And that was important to me that that Romy got to see the way people actually live. And Sumaya is definitely evidence of that. Another character who appears later on in the book and it also turns out to be very pivotal to the story. So, yeah. And Sumaya was my answer to, in the original Around the World in 80 Days, Phileas Fogg falls in love with an Indian woman who's, being thrown on the funeral pyre of her husband's funeral pyre. And it's like, I mean, it's a well-meaning story. He meant well, but it's so paternalistically dismissive of other religions around the world. If you're not a, you know, a white Christian, you're ignorant or behind the times. And it's so dismissive. And so for me, it was really fun to create this character who wasn't rescued by the main characters, but is a force of in and of herself and is determined to solve her own problems and to rescue herself. So Sumaya was a like really cool character for me to work with. So yeah, the whole experience of writing this book has been so much fun. And I just love the idea of literary travel. So I'm so delighted that you guys are doing it too, because it really, no, but it does, it absolutely changes your perspective on the world. And I have to say that it's been the hardest thing for me, during COVID is that I've been, you know, we've all been unable to travel and I had to cancel the research trip for the book that I'm just finishing right now, which is called An Accidental Odyssey, and it's a retracing of Odysseus's journey home from the Trojan War. And it's a young woman who's a food blogger, and she's chasing her crazy father as he's trying to retrace Odysseus's journey, and he's ailing. And anyway, and it is like it has been very magical and very fun to write. And luckily, last year when I did the round the world trip, I spent quite a bit of time in Italy, but I didn't go to Greece, and I was supposed to be in Greece this year and didn't make it. So I'm very sad about that.
It sounds like you have a thing for chefs and food bloggers.
Yeah.
There's a very food-directed vein.
Yeah. So Dom's a food blogger he's a chef, right? And so he has an Instagram. He doesn't really blog. He has an Instagram that he displays food, and he just loves feeding people. He deeply understands how much food is love. And so that's that I feel makes him an extremely enticing character.
Hey, I've been cooking every meal for the last 5 months. I would love for someone to cook for me.
Exactly. That's what we need. We need to find somebody. We all need a Dom in our life for sure.
Absolutely. What if you are the Dom in people's lives and you just realized it?
Anything in the book you did, meaning gone to a place like you researched this firsthand.
I did almost everywhere. I couldn't get into Africa. So that was really hard. I really wanted to go to Suez, and I couldn't get in. There were travel advisories at the time that I was going, and I was not able to get in there. So but the rest of it I went through. I mean, I was in Japan. The day I left Japan, there was an earthquake when I was in the airport that was amazing. I left Hong Kong the day the riots started. So while I was in Hong Kong, there were posters everywhere, and the posters were, complaining about all these missing persons, I didn't know what any of this was, and literally things blew up the day that I left. So and there was the heat wave in India. There was when I was in. I crawled into a hole in the ground in France that I have never had an experience like that in my life before. And it was definitely a life-changing experience where I had a tour in the ancient underground mines beneath Paris. And it's a spot that is completely illegal to be down there. I was with the only person who's got, who has permission to travel underneath the ground. And it was a very spontaneous thing, wasn't planned at all. And I ended up with mud to my armpits and terrified out of my mind, but it was the most amazing experience. And so all of these things happened on this research trip. And so it was definitely worth taking that trip to go, because I think it made the book richer.
Oh, heck yeah. There's one thing about explaining a landscape, right? Like, you can describe a beautiful picture that someone's taken,
yeah,
and you can put yourself there, but describing experiences, unless you're literally taking someone else's words, is very difficult to do if you haven't done it.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. And I think that, obviously I'm writing a piece of fiction here. I think everybody understands that. Interestingly enough, with Finding Fraser, I would have to say about 10% of the fan mail that I got actually believed that I was Emma.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So that's pretty interesting, when I would have to say, oh, that wasn't me. It was just a character I created. My Scotland experience is a lot deeper. One of my children lives in Scotland, and so I'm there quite often. And my family historically came from Scotland, so I had a family background there as well. So my understanding of Scotland was deeper, but I think that made a difference to when I was writing Finding Fraser, because I really wanted, Emma writes a love letter to Scotland. And, she's trying to find her Fraser, but she falls in love with the country. And I'm sure you can understand that, having been there. It is an amazing place.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Too many. I almost said too many. There's no such thing as too many times.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, absolutely fell for it. I am fascinated with a number of the things that, Romy did. I mean, all of it is very, you know, entertaining and I'll say scary, but potentially dangerous,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, and this is like taking us back a step or 20. Did you actually go get all banged up from a travel clinic?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Had to get a lot of shots, many, many shots. And one of which I need to go back because, for Japanese encephalitis, which is a kind of, it's a mosquito-borne illness, and it's called Japanese encephalitis, but you don't just catch it in Japan. You catch it it's a disease that you can get in any sort of warm country, and you have to get a booster like a year later. So I'm due for my booster for Japanese encephalitis still. So I still have to go back to a travel clinic. But yes, Romy suffers while for her art for sure.
And something that I thought it was very interesting, because even though I have not done it, I haven't made any reservations. I haven't even really in detail researched this, but I have considered traveling via container ship. Did you do that?
No, I did not do that, but I do know people who have done it, and it is doable. It is absolutely doable. I didn't even know it was a thing until I started researching for the book. And yeah, so there's quite a few people that have done it. You can Google it actually, and you can see some of the experiences that people have. I mean, it varies on it varies depending on the ship. And like some of the things that happen in the book couldn't possibly happen in real life. The way I write my books is that I want them, I do not mind if they are improbable. I just don't want them to be impossible. So I don't want to give my characters something to do that is absolutely impossible, that it could not happen. But I don't mind if the improbability factor is high, because sometimes that makes it more fun. But it is definitely possible to travel by container ship. And there's some people that do all their travel that way. It's like one of the things that's not really talked about with travel. Like, for example, I think I was traveling I travel mostly on my own. I'm a single person, and my kids are grown up now. And so, if I can meet somebody while I'm traveling or go for a little way while somebody is with me, that's awesome. But often, usually I'm on my own. And so I think I was traveling about 5 years before I learned about, you know, that you could stay at a university in the summer. And so I didn't, you know, a lot of times this isn't advertised, but you can stay in student housing in the summer in rooms that are, you know, very comfortable. And they're better appointed than many hotel rooms. And they're on beautiful old college campuses. And that's I didn't know about that. So it's the same kind of thing as the travel on different types of vessels. It is definitely possible. It's not possible to crew on a
Greenpeace ship?
Yeah, Greenpeace ship. That's not possible. But you know what? I had to put a Greenpeace ship in there because I'm from Vancouver and Greenpeace started in Vancouver. So, you know, I had to throw a Greenpeace ship in there. I had to get my girl to Alaska somehow. So that's anyway, so that's how that happened.
It was written so like, oh my gosh, I can only imagine being up there, being trapped and with this other tourist. What the yeah. Burping, hiccuping tourist.
I knew you were gonna mention her. Yeah, that actually did happen. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that actually did happen.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it was really entertaining. And so the thing was, this poor lady had the hiccups and she was burping and every time on every hiccup. But unlike Romy, who's in the car alone with her, like just the two ladies, the two other tourists and herself, and then the guy who's running the car. I was in a car where there was about 55 people crammed in. It was very claustrophobic. They had jammed, I mean, obviously couldn't do it today, but there was like no room to move. And I was jammed up against this poor lady who was desperately ill because she was so frightened. And so, you know, like I can't have something like that happen to me and not work it into the book. you know, it's the same.
Well, that's what I was kind of afraid of.
Yeah. So if there is a certain extra vividness to that, then that is because it came from life. Yeah, for sure. I also met Rabbi in the Highlands.
Oh, wow.
Rabbi the tripod. Yeah. I met him in the Highlands when I was in a bar, and I was writing in a bar. So obviously it wasn't exactly the way that happened, the way that unfolded in that particular story. And as a matter of fact, it was so much worse what he was saying that I couldn't use it because it was too filthy. So because he was a Glaswegian. And so it was pretty funny and like not scary. It wasn't a scary thing. It was I never felt like I was at risk or in danger in any way, but this was a very determined person who really wanted to get to know me better. And it was, yeah. So it was really good because I was able to do that, you know, to work that in for Emma in the story. So you see, these are the places that, the actual, you know, doing the actual research is very valuable to storytelling. I remember Diana when she discovered Hangman's Grease, and that's in one of the early books. And that is a thing, you know, that is a thing. And I didn't know it was a thing. And I remember when she was writing about that and talking about the research behind it when we were on the writers forum. And you know, there's the problem with being a writer is that you can fall into a research hole and never crawl out of it again because the research is so interesting. But if you are, it's a very joyful experience if you're able to take that research and put it to good use in your story.
Who was your Swiss German consultant? I am very impressed because they didn't just use French or German.
Yeah.
Because I lived there in 1996. I worked for a summer in Canton Bern, which is a little bit outside in the Swiss German speaking part, but we did visit the French speaking part. But because of the mélange of all the languages there, they say merci fimo, which is merci viel mal, which is how it's perfectly written. But it's, and I know the pronunciation doesn't matter because it's written, but at least where I was, it was fimo. Mm-hmm. So sort of, they kind of like went oh with the L's, mm-hmm. they kind of swallowed the L's, mm-hmm. but it's spelled merci. No, sorry. They didn't even say merci. They said mercy.
Yeah.
Merci fimo. Yeah. And I was like, what? Yeah. I've never seen any author do that correctly.
Yay. That's so great.
No, I'm serious. Cause that is some really, I won't say esoteric, but really niche knowledge. I would not have known that, even though I spoke in German for almost 30 years now, I would never have known that to know if it was right or wrong or whatever, unless I had lived there.
Right.
I could have studied German my entire life and never lived there. I would not have known. So this is such a small thing to pick up, but holy crap.
Oh, see that, that gives me such a thrill that pleased you. That absolutely, totally makes my day because I have been to that part of Switzerland. Not for many, many years. And I just remembered it so vividly. So I did a deep dive and tried to make sure that I found that. And actually I had to defend that because my, my proofreader who was absolutely meticulous and it's absolutely wonderful, copy editor who was doing the copy edit and the proofread caught it and said, I don't think this is German. And said, it's not, it's Swiss German and it's very particular to this one place. And so I actually ended up finding, someone who said it out loud online that I could find so that I could phoneticize it as best I could. I mean, you know, you can only do the best that you can do. And in retrospect, there's probably a ton of mistakes in this book that I have made through my own ignorance, but they're all my own mistakes and I want to own them. So, but in that particular case, I'm really thrilled that you noticed that and that it resonated with you.
You don't need to own all the mistakes because I did get a PDF that for some reason when I downloaded it, every FL was missing the L and every FI was missing the I. And I lost an hour of time trying to figure out what fapping fags was. Because They absolutely are words. They are British slang, but I had never heard them used together. And I sent it to my linguist friends. I sent it to my sister and friends. And I was like, what are fapping fags outside of a gentleman's club? I don't understand.
Summer, you should have emailed me.
Oh my God.
I would have fallen on the floor with laughter then too. I'm so sorry. I don't know how that happened.
No, it had to be. No, that's the thing. She had the same file.
We had the same PDF. I downloaded it. I don't have that error. That's what I'm telling you. So it must have been something in the Gremlins when you download it. Sometimes things happen to text.
Yeah. It had to be my computer. It had to totally be my computer. But we were dying.
That is funny.
And we were trying to imagine, like, is it a relationship to the cigarettes? Like a bunch of people just making out with cigarettes out front of the gentleman's club? I'm like, were there actual fags fapping? I'm like, really I don't.
It so was, I'm assuming that this was flapping flags, right?
It was flapping. Absolutely.
Oh, I'm so sorry. That is, yeah, but okay. I own that one too, Summer. I guess I own that one too.
You don't have to own it. It had to have been my computer and how it downloaded it, but it was so funny. Like I was in tears.
That is funny.
I was in tears.
What are you doing in your free time? Playing Best Fiends, I hope. And if you're not playing Best Fiends yet, you should be. It is hours of fun you can enjoy anytime. I am hooked. And if you're anything like me, you will be too. No Wi-Fi? No worries. You don't even need an internet connection to play.
And now that I've been... I I'm so special. Now that we've been staying home a lot more, because it's not just me, I have found I have a lot more opportunity to have some socially distant competition with friends. And I love the different characters getting extra points and doing the wheel. I mean, Fiend of Fortune after the Wheel of Fortune. And upgrading characters to see how they evolve and see how they look. And lately, I've been crushing on Vega, a little yellow flying-like creature. And I think I'm a little bit above, but I couldn't check in the game just now. I tried to check quickly and I couldn't, but I know I'm at least on level 140. So Summer, I broke 100.
Woohoo! That deserves
I know
applause.
It's still laughing matter to you. I know. We're way behind you.
So I have still, as I have been for the last 5 months, been in an area with this that does not have consistently good internet. And I love this game because, as I said before, it does not require the internet to play. So you don't have to worry about Wi-Fi access or using your cell data. I am currently on approximately level 641. And now, that may sound like I am slowing down in my gameplay a little bit, but the levels are just getting more challenging and I can't resist a good side mission. It is hours of fun right at your fingertips.
Best Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters added every month. It's hours of fun right at your fingertips, and you can even play offline.
With over 100 million downloads and tons of 5-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play.
That's friends without the R, Best Fiends.
Is there anything that for such an endeavor, right? How did your process change at all? Maybe not your writing process, but your prep process. How has that, either before you left or now that you're back from such a trip?
Yeah. So what happened was that I wrote the book before I left. I wrote it to first draft. And then I went on the trip. And every day that I was on the trip, I wrote like a maniac. I wrote on every train. I wrote on every plane. I wrote on every boat because I had to change everything, you know, because yeah, well, you know, like, I mean, essentially the love story is there. The love story remains the same. The stories, but just the nature of being in the various places, it was so important to me that I bring this story to life. And so being able to sit in a cafe. So for example, the scene that I had in Paris, where I was very determined that Romy was going to have to chase through the catacombs of Paris. I really wanted her to run through now underneath Paris, there are these ancient catacombs and they're a boneyard basically. And so it's a kilometer long and it's an ossuary, which is a place where old bones from old graveyards were piled up and stored. It's a tourist attraction, but it's also an amazing sort of breathtaking place because you can see that, you know, there's walls that are made entirely only of femurs. You know, it is just the most amazing, macabre, remarkable place. There's a little sign that says at the entrance that says in French, you know, stop, you're entering the gates of hell. And it's an amazing place. And I had planned for Romy to run through this, you know, this is a race and she is literally racing through Paris. So, you know, the morning that I was in Paris, I was there during a massive heat wave last year. It was so, so hot. And the lineups were it was lots and lots of tourists around. And so I went at 7 in the morning and went and had tea, found a tea shop that was open and sat and waited until the catacombs opened and then got in line so that I was able to get through. And it was an amazing sort of breathtaking experience to go through these ancient caves that were built basically as a result of the fact that Paris had overfilled its graveyards, and in the 1700s one of the graveyards started to collapse into the backyards of some of wealthy people, and they didn't want to have all these, you know, these bones sticking up through their yards. So they scooped up all the bones and they threw them into these deep underground chalk tunnels that were, you may have heard of Plaster of Paris. Well, Plaster of Paris was mined. It was a limestone that was mined from underneath the outskirts, where the outskirts of Paris, you know, from the 1400s or even before, early on. So up to 1,000 years ago. And so there's actually 300 miles of these tunnels underneath the old parts of Paris. And so anyway, they took a couple of hundred years ago, they took some of the bones that had been tossed in there and they built this ossuary, which is known as the Paris Catacombs. So you can tour it. And I thought it would be fantastic. And it was fantastic. And it was completely wrong for the story. 100% wrong. And so I walked through this tunnel and I was so, so disappointed. And I thought, there's no way, you know, it was so regulated. There's no way she could get loose in there without, you know, with the freedom to run through this tunnel. And, you know, I was so disappointed. Well, so I finished, I climbed out of the tunnel and I sat down, found another coffee shop and sat down and was working on the story. So I had texted my daughter, who's an archaeologist, and she said, listen, I know this guy who works in Paris. He's an amazing guy and he has a real understanding of underground Paris. So I emailed him and asked him if he was free. We only had, you know, a couple of hours where he was around and I was around. And so we met and he agreed he was going to take me on a tour of the Le Petit Ceinture, which is this old railway track that used to connect Paris, but it's now not used at all. So it's below the ground, but not as deep as the metro, which is, you know, a subway station, right? So we were walking along these old railway tracks and it was so amazing. And I thought, this is what I can use. You know, I can have Romy running through these tracks. This will work just fine. So we went into this old tunnel and he was showing me the markings on the wall. The markings on the wall were, you know, indicated the gauge of the railway and how far it was until the next exchange spot. They all had significance. And he's describing these things to me. And this man is Parisian French, but he's speaking to me in English. I have a little French, but not very much. Suddenly, right between our feet, two lights appear. So we're in this darkened railway tunnel. And suddenly, out of the blue, two lights appear coming out of the ground. And I literally jumped. And these two guys crawl out from a hole in the ground. And they're covered in muck, head to toe, and they're wearing headlamps. And so they turn to, you know, there's a conversation in French with my companion, whose name is Gilles Thomas. And when he introduces himself, these two guys who were so scary to me, but once I actually saw who they were, they looked like they were about 18 years old, very cute. And they shook his hand like they were meeting a rock star. And then they hurried off. And I said, like, what was that all about? And he said, oh, they just found out who I am. And I said, you know, like, that's so Gallic French, you know, oh, they found out who I am. Like, how could they not be impressed? And so I was like, you know, I'm not going to take that, right? So I said, okay, well, like, what was all this about? And he said, well, I have permission from the mayor. And he said, what they're doing is completely illegal. You're not allowed to crawl through these tunnels. It's completely illegal. But I have permission because I'm the person that mapped them out. And he has. He's written a book that's mapped out all these 300 kilometers of tunnels that are like underneath the deep, deep under the ground. So this is under the catacombs. It's under the metro, the subway station. It's under the water, the sewage. It's under everything. They're deep underground. They're mines. They're essentially old abandoned mine shafts. So these two guys have left and he's standing there and he's like, oh, you know, all full of himself. And so he looks at me and says, do you want to go down? So like, there is no way I want to go into this hole in the ground. There is no way I want to do that. But my daughter introduced me to him. And all I can think is that if I say no, she is going to taunt me for the rest of my life that I had this opportunity. So I said yes. And so he had a headlamp in his backpack. So we each put on a headlamp and I crawled backwards through this hole in the ground. And we crawled through these tunnels that for the first little while were marked with graffiti. So obviously lots of illegal use of the tunnels. And I'm just convinced that if we come across someone, they're going to just murder us because nobody knows where I am. I'm under the ground with this man that I've only just met, you know, buried. What if there's an earthquake? Like, what if the tunnels collapse, which apparently they do all the time. And so I'm chasing him through these tunnels underground. And, you know, I have my story. It gives me my story. And so it was worth it. It was so worth it. And ironically, at the end, when we did escape, we actually did get stopped by the police while we were under there. A large group of police who were doing a training session came to arrest us. And then we were allowed to go free because I was with Gilles. And so afterwards, I very, you know, full of myself, called my daughter and I said, you're not going to believe what your mother was up to. And she said, oh, you're kidding. She said, he never took us down there. We just went into some little, you know, reenactment of a resistance cell. And it wasn't even under the ground. So here, the only reason I'd done this was so that she wouldn't taunt me that she had done it and I was too scared. And she hadn't even done it. So,
oh my gosh.
Anyway, it was great. And I had my story for Romy. I had exactly what she needed to do. And so it was, I think, you know, it adds something to the story when she's having her race under the ground in Paris.
Oh, heck yeah. That was definitely suspenseful because you're like, oh my gosh, is she going to, you know, is she going to, we knew she couldn't die that soon because, you yeah. know,
there were so many more pages. There were so many more pages.
But we didn't know. Yeah. I mean, knew that she was probably going to be places outside of Paris. But still, it was like, oh gosh, that's one thing I will say. One of the things I will say for this is that it's I think it's a quick read because once it gets you pretty quickly, you know, it gets you hooked pretty quickly. And then once she started her adventure, her travels, like almost not immediately, she's on a boat immediately, but pretty quickly into the travel proper, Paris happens.
Right.
And so that is like, I mean, if you weren't already into it, that hooks you right Good. There because you're like, what the heck?
But to be fair, I was super glad that if she had to get pickpocketed anywhere, that it was in France.
Oh, yeah. I was actually pickpocketed in France myself. So,
see.
You know, yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, not the same circumstance at all. But why? Explain that to me, Summer. Why was that significant to you?
To me, it was significant to me that it happened in a place that is not stereotypically seen as being downtrodden or third world.
Oh, right.
Or
yeah.
Bad. Right. So mm-hmm. to me, it was like in this place of not affluence, but a place where you consider it to be full of history and full of mm-hmm. French people.
Quote unquote, the safe West.
Yeah. yeah. And I enjoyed that she was actually at her safest mm-hmm. in yeah. the places where people would imagine they would be unsafe.
But that's true. That's true about the world. This is what, I mean, I think that we have a, this is something that you learn when you travel, is that we have such a deep misunderstanding about safety and humanity and the regard for each other's lives in the West versus being in some of the nations that we so-called deem third world. You know, it's the generosity of spirit that exists around the world, and where people truly have nothing, they are the ones that are the first to help.
How can someone find out more? Heck, get the book. When is it coming out? Where can they find it? Where is all this going to happen?
Okay, so the book is coming out. It's coming out on August 11th. It'll be available everywhere. You can pre-order it now. All the links are at my website, which is caseydyer.com. We've built Romy's Instagram. So what I've been doing for the past couple of months on Instagram is I've been putting little sneak peeks of the pictures that Romy took while she was on her trip around the world. And those are going to appear on her Instagram. Is going to appear on my website in the next week or so. You'll be able to see all the various stops. So every chapter in this story opens with a description of the Instagram shot that Romy has taken. And so I actually took all these pictures. And so these pictures, show up from around the world. So in Liverpool and in London and in the Rocky Mountains and in Niagara Falls and in Paris and all the places that, like on the very tops of the Alps. If you check my website, you'll find all the information there.
And is the puppy on your Instagram the one that's been barking at us?
Actually they have their own Instagram too. So yeah. So Puck and Tear. Yes. They've been kicking the door, but actually it's getting hot. So they're finally starting to slow down. So that's good. Anyway, thanks. I'm so glad to talk about this story. It's really a lot of fun and I hope people enjoy it as much fun reading as I had writing it.
It was a quick hook and knowing that I had, at least for myself, and I think Summer, I don't know if she had the exact same plan I did, but I knew that once we got it, obviously I had to finish it before we chatted. So I looked at the number of chapters, I divided it up by the number of days, and I read a little bit each day, or not a little bit, but a lot each day. I'm not going to lie. I went over my allotted chapters sometimes because I had to figure out, I had to get, see what
good.
Happened next.
Good. That makes me happy.
You have to find a soft resting place before you can put it down.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. She does sleep once in a while in the book. So that does.
It's helpful.
That helps.
Even if it means she has to be knocked out to do so.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. So look for that new book coming out August 11th. Is that what we said?
That's right.
Aha. I did hear it.
You did.
Very special thanks to this episode's co-producer, Courtney G. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon, what a co-producer is, and all the other things that you goodies you might get from therefrom. Find out more at outlanderpod.com/Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. And thank you to author Casey Dyer for joining us and sharing all about your next book. We can't wait to share this episode so people can get as excited about it as we are and then start following you and later Romy on Instagram and see more about her travels. And for people to finally get the book.
I'm excited too. Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, you're very welcome. Anytime.
Thank you.
Of course, of course. So thank you, everybody. Summer, you got to be here. Casey, thank you. Ginger, you got to be here. Thank you, dear listener, for joining us again. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at
Outlander Pod.